ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Like many small business owners, we are literally just buying ourselves a job. It would be better if the government just got a little bit out of our way and just let us do what we need to do.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
As the three-day inquiry into the government's proposed NDIS changes gets underway, the opposition isn't ruling out an extension. With over 4,000 submissions, there are concerns over the impact of the changes on the community and the sweeping powers that would be granted to the minister. So, could the Greens and the Coalition form an unlikely alliance to extend inquiries into both the NDIS and the big tax changes? And as the Prime Minister looks to pass the measures by the midwinter break coming up, could this leave his budget changes in limbo? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Melissa Clark.
And Melissa Clark, highly anticipated Senate inquiry into the NDIS changes is underway. I mean, this is high stakes stuff. A lot of negativity about these changes, I've got to say, so far. I'm not hearing much positive. The savings or the cuts, however you want to frame it, are a huge part of the government's forward estimates. $185 billion in savings over the decade. Only three-day inquiry. I mean, inevitably, I reckon we'll get a longer inquiry. It's my call that we will see a deal on that, that you know, this won't be enough.
You think it's done? It's going to be more than 3 days.
I think there'll be a bigger inquiry. It suits the opposition as well to try and maybe get a longer sort of look at tax changes. Let's see, but that's what I think. But these are very contentious. The government, though, is banking on the fact that the coalition politically can't say no to this.
And I think we've got even a hint from that from Angus Taylor today. He's repeating his line that, you know, every Australian wants a sustainable NDIS is what he has said. And it's very clear because it is a huge problem for the budget bottom line. But the reason there's so much negativity about it is because the moment you try and rein in the costs, there are people who will lose out on supports from this. So this is a hard job to tackle economically, and it's a hard job to tackle politically, because at the moment we know there is a series of problems with the NDIS that make reining in its costs very difficult. They range from the lack of alternative supports that the federal government has been trying to shove the states and territories into providing for quite some time now, but we still don't have much more beyond the concept of this thriving kids ideas. It's not terribly fleshed out. So the question is, all right, if we rein in the NDIS, what are the alternatives? That's not clear yet. And the opposition has certainly been pointing to that as one of the key things. Another one is just the scale of what the government is trying to do and the speed with which it's trying to do it in this process is another key question. We've got a number of the support groups that are giving evidence in these hearings over the next couple of days are saying, look, we've barely had a chance to get our heads around this. There seem to be significant measures in here that allow for further changes to be made down the track without having to come back to legislative changes again. So we're a bit worried about that. We're worried about the timing, the scope of them, and the fact that some of these changes won't be appealable if they go through as currently listed. So then even if things don't go right, there's no way to try to address them within the new system that's being proposed. So I think in an overall sense, all three of those factors are adding to that volume of negativity that you talked about, PK, where there are so many people concerned about all of these different aspects. And the government hasn't really, beyond its initial announcement of this, been able to give clearer reassurances that those elements can be addressed.
Yeah, and I don't think they will be able to in any clear time, and very fast, actually, Mel. Like, I think there is a lot still to be designed here, and clear guarantees are not about to happen. And the government, I think, is probably, yes, there's a backlash, but if they look like they're getting on top of spending, and while there might be a backlash from those who, of course, are directly affected, as you would expect, in fact, the broader hope they have is that because the NDIS has been losing support and people think too much is being spent on it, that they will be given grudging, you know, support broadly from the public, that they're at least doing something about it.
I think that's a really good point, because it brings us to the difference here between the policy and the politics, right? The policy is very difficult. There are a lot of questions that are causing uncertainty for people, and the compounding effect of a lot of them, like some programs will be cut, but then also the level of funding for some allied health supports cut. And what does that mean with those two things together? And then if I can't appeal them, what does that mean? There's this difficult part for the government. But in some ways, the politics of this for the government is much clearer. They will likely get credit for being seen as responsible economic managers tackling this issue of one of the fastest ballooning cost items in the budget. We have a coalition that is also promising to be responsible economic managers and frankly would be quite happy if the government did the hard work of tackling these questions for them now, so that when they get into government in some time in the future, they don't have to deal with it. So for all of the frustration and difficulty and questions, chances are this is going to pass through Parliament with the support of the coalition. The politics is much simpler than the actual policy design.
And it's interesting, some of the critiques of this coming from their own base, if you like, the ACTU raising concerns that there's a restriction on NDIS access for those receiving worker compensation. They don't want that to be the case. Like, watch that space. It'll be interesting to see if the government makes sure there are carve-outs that suit the unions and others who are calling for changes. I suspect they might go a bit wobbly on some of those things.
But so, what do you think, PK, about the coalition's politics here? Because as much as we know that there is a desire to bring these costs under a greater level of control from the coalition, we've also seen Melissa McIntosh, who's the shadow NDIS minister, come out and talk about how she's fought to make sure that we have at least these few days of hearings, that it's really important that this is aired. Do you think they're trying to have it a bit both ways, trying to say, look, we do want to make sure that costs are reined in, but also let's hear all of these frustrations and difficulties, and if that's a bit uncomfortable for Labor, great from a political point of view. How do you think they play trying to be seen to be supporting those who are concerned about the government's approach, but also kind of wanting the outcome that the government's working towards?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a bit of a division inside the coalition, truthfully. Mm-hmm. I think people like Melissa McIntosh, and she's not the only one, they weren't against reining in the NDIS. They think that should happen, but they did think that the coalition could definitely be a bit more nuanced about this so that they could extract maximum, not only politics, but also compassion for some of the people who would suffer. You can think about the way you would play this as an opposition. I mean, we know Labor did. You know, every day you'd have a different person out who was potentially going to be kicked off. But I think it's still overwhelmingly the view in the coalition is that they just can't stand in the way of something like this. It's just too much in their bailiwick, you know, which is reining in costs, spending of big programs. It is just too core to their identity to take a different position.
So that comes then to the question of timing, because the government wants to try and get this through as quickly as possible. They are counting on this reining in of the NDIS, the reducing its growth down to a much more sustainable pathway, down to a 5 or 6%, and then ultimately down to a 2% growth trajectory. It wants to start that process almost straight away. That's what it's accounted for in its budget papers. But now we've got this, you know, inquiry going away through parliamentary processes. We've got this big push from the Greens who are saying this is totally inadequate. There should be no rush. We need to make sure alternatives are in place. Do you think the coalition is likely to want to help the government expedite this process, or would the coalition have some sympathy or willingness, political or policy-wise, to stretching out this process?
I think they'll end up stretching out. I don't think it's going to be a really long stretch out, though. I think they understand that they need to get on board, because if I was the government, I'd be, you know, weaponising that, wouldn't you? Like that they talk about wanting to save money, but that they won't when
there's
it comes
down to it. There's
a
political risk if they stretch it out too much.
But like 3-day inquiry, I think most of us actually, let's use the common person test, the pub test, whatever. Maybe you don't like pubs, but the test, 3 days is not enough scrutiny for something like this. It's just not. I don't know anyone who could argue that. It's just clear. So I don't think it's dangerous for them to extend it. Anyway, we'll see if they end up doing a deal with the Greens. There are dangers there, of course, of the Greens teaming up with the right side of politics to delay anything. However, I think if they both get something that suits them, it's, you know, I'm sure the Greens aren't crying out of fear that they'll be seen as, you know, doing a deal on an inquiry. It's hardly substantive stuff. It's about scrutiny.
I'm not sure,
right?
That's the bit that cracks through to the general population, yeah, that might,
no,
not be paying too much attention to politics.
I don't know, sort of like at their water coolers today saying, how's about the length of those inquiries? Although the nerds that listen to this podcast probably are, so love you guys.
Depends which water cooler, PK, yeah,
exactly.
Which water cooler.
The nerd water cooler. All right, I want to pivot to something that I think is today a big story, but I suspect is one of those stories that's going to slow burn, baby. It is the story that will be your story for the next decade, and that is artificial intelligence, the revolution it's causing in our workplaces, the revolution it will cause in our environment, and that's exactly what Independent Senator David Pocock is going to. He's penned an interesting op-ed in The Guardian today. He's called for a fair return for Australians amid this data center boom. Now, we know from the last figures that even came out that the only reason our economy is even growing is investment in these data centres, our government.
Isn't that extraordinary?
It is actually extraordinary.
That is what is holding our economy into positive growth territory, is relying on this one very new, rapidly growing, as someone I know who works in the sector described it to me, as the Wild West at the moment, that this is what is keeping our economy in positive territory. I mean, sure, Australia's long been reliant on the mining sector for a huge amount of our growth. But to have this kind of influence on the development of data centres in such a very narrow, specific point of time, I think that just gives, it's really representative of the scale of how important this is, whether you want it or not, or whether you're for it or against it or have concerns about it, the scale of the impact is huge.
You're right, it's huge. And there are huge political consequences in other places where these things have been rolled out, perhaps without that social licence. So in the United States, it's already a big issue in their midterm elections. There are moratoriums against building these things in some states. People have not, like, these companies have not built a social license. They suck water, they suck this kind of energy, and unless you have real serious guardrails about how to do it, which our government, can I say, the Albanese government says they will do, that they will ensure that they have to essentially be self-sufficient, that they don't, you know, steal the energy of consumers and then jack up everyone's prices as a result. So that's happening. But what's interesting is that he also made a taxation point, I thought. He says we cannot, this he being David Pocock, he says we cannot afford to make the same mistakes as we did with gas. If tech companies are going to use our land, energy and water for AI, they must pay their, and I'm ready to say it, the cliche of our generation, fair share of tax.
This is really interesting because I think it goes to what people's broader expectations are from the AI revolution. And I think we're seeing really divergent paths here about communities and economies and political entities about whether they see AI as a positive force to be enhanced and for benefits to be reaped from, in which case we want to encourage any development related to that to your area. And that means putting in place systems and approaches that support the development of data centres and other infrastructure that help AI. On the flip side, there are those who are very concerned about the taxation implications, as we have here, the environmental implications, the social implications of the development of AI and the construction process that comes with that, and question what are the benefits and are they worth a state, a nation, a local council throwing resources and support towards to try and garner. And different people are coming to different views about this. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned some of those, you know, positions in the United States where we see some communities very concerned and not wanting to see further development. We can look to places like India, where various states are absolutely throwing money at data center developers and AI developers to try and have these facilities being built in their country, in their communities, because they see attendant benefits with having them there. I think what we're getting from David Pocock here is a real kickstart of the debate of what does AI and the technology that comes with it bring to our community. And if all we're talking about in data center development is the initial construction of the thing, and there's not anything else that comes with that guaranteed to Australia, be it taxation or ongoing jobs or skills development, then is that something we actually want to encourage? Now, the government point of view is, now they will point to their statement of expectations that they released, I think it was earlier this year or late last year, that sets out what they expect from AI companies and from data center developers. And that goes to things like adding to the stability of the electricity grid if they want to set up a data center, or providing sustainable water usage patterns if they want to set up a data center, and looking for ongoing development of domestic skilled workforce contributions. So these are all things that they are looking for AI and data center companies to provide if they are to be preferenced and given support from the government. But none of this is hard and fast. These are guidelines. These are expectations. There are no rules. And different state governments and different local councils have really different views about what they want in their area and how much to throw towards getting them. So I think David Pocock's intervention asking more broadly beyond the electricity and water resources question to, hang on, what does Australia get by being at the forefront of this? What is there beyond the initial blip of the construction process is a really important question that we need to ask, that tells us not just how this is helping our economy right now in terms of the investment and keeping economic growth positive, what's it going to look like in 10 years? And is this where we want to be throwing our resources? And what are our systems in place so that we're getting benefits in 10 years' time, not just supporting our economic growth right now?
Well, Eddie Husic is the former minister, of course, responsible for this area, was dumped as a minister, now has very strong views from the backbench on it. He raised the alarm on our colleague Steve Kinnane's Four Corners story last night. He talked about his concerns around the voluntary national expectations of AI data centres and infrastructure, no enforceable regulation. So it is coming from inside the party too, not just the Pococks. But it's one of those, I see it as a real slow burn, this story. I don't know if it's hit sort of everyday discourse yet for Australians, but it will become bigger and bigger and bigger as people realise there's a data centre down the road and they don't like the sound. By the way, people don't like the sound. You know this, Mel. Like, the sound's really annoying, apparently. So is this our wind farm problem? Like, remember when everyone couldn't stand the sound? People probably still hate the sound. But, you know, like, you do big things like this and you get lots of unintended consequences.
Yeah, the sound is one of them. The fire risk is another one, yes, that we've been reporting on at the ABC, yes, of, oh, guess what? As well as having these big power supplies, you need big backups. And that means a lot of diesel and a lot of lithium batteries. And often that's in suburban areas. Mm. What are the risks? Are we adequately accounting for the scale of that risk? Things like data sovereignty is another one that the opposition has pointed to a number of times. Have we factored in sufficient safeguards for data for Australian companies and individuals, and how are they being safeguarded? This is the thing, when you have such a Wild West developing sector, there are more questions you ask, the more questions you come up with. And the government is trying to figure out how to regulate oversight in real time. I think inevitably with these things, regulation becomes a bit of a lag factor. The question is not letting it become too much of a lag factor.
So while this is all going on, the backstory continues in our country, which is, just final thoughts here, the rise of One Nation, the government under pressure on those questions. There's a piece of data out today that I think tells us everything we need to know about the rise of populism and the trouble the government's in. And we know that, for instance, Angus Taylor today blaming essentially Labor's budget for his party's dismal showing, which I think's a bit of a stretch, Angus, if you're listening, a bit of a stretch to blame someone else's budget for your unpopularity. I mean, I get why it's maybe making Labor unpopular, but I think it might be a bit more complex. Now, he attributes it all to anger, anger, anger in the community. Well, he's right, there's anger. But I'll tell you this one. The closely watched Westpac Melbourne Institute measure of confidence, which is consumer price, shows it slipped 2.9% this month. It is close to its lowest level in its 50-year history. So what does that mean? Well, the nation's shoppers basically are really pessimistic because of the cost of living, the war in Iran, which of course flared up in the last couple of days. I just think it's a piece of data that brings to our attention that Australians are really, really feeling the heat. And I don't think there's much surprise about why they're looking at different political options at the moment.
When there's a huge amount of uncertainty, you point to the Middle East is a huge one. I think we know more interest rate rises are coming before they go away. There's a lot of uncertainty in the property sector thanks to the proposed tax changes, and we still don't know exactly what form they'll look like if they can get through Parliament, but we know that people are holding back on decision making. There are really big question marks over people's both immediate and long-term financial planning right now. So it's not surprising that people are holding back from making purchasing decisions, being a bit more cautious, and perhaps thinking a little more widely. I think the real test really comes at a ballot box. For the federal sphere, that's still a bit of a way away. I think there's still really big questions around preferencing. Tony Abbott's interjection to say that he's willing to preference one nation in seats coming in contests coming up is a really notable one for his journey. But I think the real test comes when people actually have to make a decision at the ballot box. We have seen some of that, the South Australian state election, the Farrah by-election. We're about to have a Victorian election a bit later in the year that's going to be really interesting to see just how much of this discontent and consideration of alternatives to the major parties, how much of that cements when it comes to marking a ballot paper in a ballot box. But I don't think there's any doubt that the global times we're in and the local circumstances are in mean that we are in a very, very different and difficult political climate compared to what we've seen at any time recently.
There is nothing like an inflation crisis to erode people's sense of well-being, and that's what we're seeing. And politics is the perfect storm. While algorithms and a lack of a sort of unifying national square where we operate in, everyone in their own ecosystems, while they're in a cost of living crisis, I think there is absolutely no surprise in any of the results we're seeing in the polls. Everything is being upended in my view, and I'm seriously thoroughly not surprised after that many years of people having their living standards slip and slip and slip that they feel this way. Well, that's it for politics now today. Mel, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I'm glad we covered everything from the detailed policy debates to broader discontent at a global level with where the world's headed. We've covered a lot of ground.
Well, you know, start small, get big. David Spears joins me on the podcast tomorrow. And if you ever got a question for us, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Fran, who's an award winner for our nation, and I will answer your question. See you, Mel.
See you, PK.